B. Collins.
News and comment for Wednesday, December 7th, 2016. 75 years ago today, Pearl Harbor occurred. And I'm still fuzzy on all the details there. But I won't denigrate the veterans who are honored today. And the valiant effort that America really waged in its War of the Pacific. But there's lots to talk about today. Julian Assange has gone public with the answers that he gave to Swedish investigators who visited him last month, where he's holed up at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And this is interesting on a number of levels. There's a cottage industry of, I take them to be wackos, but a friend has been linking me to a guy on YouTube who wears a Trump Make America Great hat and rambles on for over 3 hours with what he says are facts, that Julian Assange is in the custody of the CIA. Other people think that he may have been snuffed. But today, the Guardian newspaper from London publishes information supplied to it by Julian Assange in a letter accompanying a document. He said, "I am releasing my statement to the public. I want people to know the truth about how abusive this process has been." Now, most people know that there are very fuzzy charges of sexual assault, which is reduced to rape in common parlance. It occurred in Sweden several years ago, I think in 2010. And what we have here is a he said, she said situation. But fundamentally, I take Julian Assange at his point that he really is being charged and prosecuted in Sweden in an effort to extradite him to the United States. And that's a very plausible scenario, going back to the damage that the government thought occurred from the WikiLeaks revelations of the trove of documents supplied by Chelsea Manning. And we know there's been an effort to get and to prosecute Julian Assange by our government. We have heard that there may be unsealed charges against him from a grand jury in the Washington, D.C. area, but I can't confirm that. So, whatever you think of Julian Assange, and I have many conflicting views of him, I do think that he is correct to assume that if he leaves the embassy of Ecuador in London, that in some form or another he will wind up in U.S. custody, will be charged under our Espionage Act, and would probably serve life in prison. I don't think that is fair, because I think he has fundamentally committed journalism. Now, this year, I believe he went a little off the deep end in a vendetta against Hillary Clinton. And the FBI director played into that. Years from now, we'll still be scratching our heads about all this. But as to the issues before Julian Assange, well, before we even get to his statement, the attorney for the accuser, an unnamed Swedish woman, the attorney is Elizabeth Fritz, said that his decision to release details of the relationship is unfortunate, and she accused Assange of violating her client in the media. "The only thing I can say is that Assange has low credibility, which we will prove when we prosecute. I expect the prosecutor to issue charges. I also expect Assange to stop violating my client in the media. She has suffered more than enough for 6 years." Well, if she is sincere and honorable, that might be the case. But when you hear Julian Assange's side of the story, as revealed in this statement that he has released, what he's telling us is that he met this woman on a visit to Sweden in 2010. And he claims that he met her and that she was kind of a groupie. He writes, "The woman appeared to be sympathetic to my plight and was also appeared to be romantically interested in me. She was not close to people I was close to, so it seemed that those who meant me harm would be unlikely to try to find me by monitoring her movements. This woman made it very clear she wanted to have sexual intercourse, said Assange. She placed his hands on her breasts while they were at a movie theater. I felt concerned about the intensity of her interest, and I also deeply loved another woman, which played on my mind and left me emotionally distracted. He continued, the intensity of her interest made him fear how she might react if she felt he was rejecting her. He claimed he later discovered she had collected dozens of pictures of him in the weeks before they met, her Flickr photo account filled with pages and pages of photos of Assange. After they had unprotected sex, she wanted him to have a test for STDs. Quote, we were in agreement and arranged to meet the following day in the nearby park around lunchtime when I would have had time to get tested. She said she was fine and seemed at ease. You can imagine my disbelief when I woke the next morning to the news that I had been arrested in my absence for rape and the police were hunting all over Stockholm for me. And Assange claims that text messages sent by the woman at the time, access to which his lawyers were only allowed briefly and a long time ago, show that she was not asleep during the sex as has been accused or charged. Quote, I was certain she was not asleep. I was also certain she expressly consented to unprotected sex before such intercourse started. The woman has insisted that a prerequisite of intercourse was that a condom be used. He claims the texts also show that the woman said at the time that she didn't want to put any charges on Julian Assange, but the police were keen on getting their hands on him, and that she was, quote, shocked when they arrested him because she only wanted him to take a test. According to the transcripts leaked to The Guardian in 2010, the woman told police that she met him at a seminar where he was speaking, went to the cinema with him where they kissed in the back row. She said 2 days later she arranged to meet him. They went to her flat. They started to have sex, but she moved away because he didn't want to wear a condom. Then he fell asleep. She told police they later had sex at least once when he had unwillingly worn a condom. But the following morning, after she had gone to buy breakfast and then climbed back into bed and fallen asleep, she had woken to find him having sex with her without a condom. So this is a he said, she said dispute. And under the laws of Sweden, this is a sexual offense. But it is not what I view to be rape. And the term rape has been widely used to describe the charges against Julian Assange, which is another example of the kind of smear tactics that have been used. So I welcome this additional information. I'm not sure where it will lead or if justice can be found in this highly jaundiced political environment. Ed Snowden, another tortured whistleblower by the Obama administration, gave an interview to the New York Times, published today. Their reporter, Stephen Erlanger, the London bureau chief, had a few questions for Snowden, and Snowden offered some interesting comments. For example, when asked whether he's a whistleblowing hero or a traitor who broke an oath, he said, well, whether or not I should be granted a pardon is not for me to answer. By partnering with journalists, I sought to exercise our democratic system of checks and balances in a series of disclosures in 2013. The NSA's system of global mass surveillance was unlawful, and the courts agreed with me. Congress ultimately changed the law, putting new restrictions on the intelligence community's powers. Now, Snowden is narrowly correct here. Congress didn't change the law by much. But I will agree that what he did was expose unlawful behavior. He went on, I never published a single document on my own. I partnered with the Washington Post and the Guardian. They received Pulitzer Prizes. This is why we have a free press in a democracy. The government has many great powers, particularly as they relate to the handling of secrets, but it's the press that is charged with determining what information is truly within the public interest. Then he's asked why he doesn't come back to face charges. Daniel Ellsberg, after all, did show up in court to face charges. He said, well, Dan Ellsberg himself has argued that I made the right decision not to present myself to a court. Things have changed since the 70s, and today the law doesn't allow you to make a defense against Espionage Act charges in front of the jury. I am legally prohibited from even speaking to the jury about my motivation. Can there be a fair trial when you can't put forward a defense? Well, I think Ed Snowden is one smart guy who understands the the forces arrayed against him. Then, when asked about what changes have occurred, he kind of answers the question with a question. Do I think things are fixed? No. Do I think that any whistleblower, any single individual, can change the world? No. But I do believe that we have some oversight over our privacy rights now and that things are improving in a material way. The U.S. now has a two-tiered system of handling surveillance. If you're a citizen, the government will go to a court to get a warrant before they spy on you. I hope he's right about that. I'm not sure that's always the case. This is almost always a secret court called FISA, which in 33 years was asked roughly 34,000 times to authorize surveillance and only said no 11 times. Now, if you're not a U.S. citizen, no warrant is required. And that's gotten a little bit better because some companies have actually begun resisting these demands. So when asked in the final question, you've said that you think of yourself as still working for the United States. And he answers, being patriotic doesn't simply mean agreeing with your government. Being willing to disagree, particularly in a risky manner, is actually what we need more of today. When we have this incredible, often fact-free environment where politicians can make claims and then they're reported as truth, how do we actually steer democracy? If we have facts, we can help facilitate democracy, and this is my role. The New York Times authored an editorial today calling on President Obama to be generous with his unlimited powers to pardon and commute, saying that with Donald Trump and his nominated Attorney General Jeff Sessions coming into power, that things are not going to get better, even as we've seen an attempt at criminal justice and sentencing reform under the Obama administration. Now, Obama has taken action in more than 1,000 cases, but I have a short list here of people who deserve his attention, and they include Ed Snowden. I would mention Julian Assange, but I don't think that he's actually qualified for a pardon because he's not a U.S. citizen. I would include Chelsea Manning, Leonard Peltier, the Native American who has been a political prisoner for more than 40 years now, and Don Siegelman, the political prisoner who we hope will be released from federal prison in February of next year. He is the former Democratic governor of Alabama, who was railroaded into that federal prison by friends of Karl Rove on a very bogus prosecution. And there are certainly many more names that could be added. But Obama has been so reserved and chintzy in his use of the pardon powers that we can't really be sure what his range will be between now and his final day in office on January 20th, 19th, somewhere in there. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Jeff Lipinski, Don Cisney, Julie Dupree, they are steady monthly subscribers and I'm grateful. And I want to give a shout out to Andrew Michaelets, who just took out a new annual subscription a couple of days ago. Andrew, welcome aboard and thanks for your support of the Peter B. Collins Podcast. You want to join in? You want to give a subscription gift for the holidays? Let me help you. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click menu, pull it down, click become a subscriber. Takes you to the sign up page. There you set up a PayPal account to chip in $5, $10, $20 a month or our $50 annual subscription. And if you're a new annual subscriber in the continental U.S., there are two bonus books you can choose from on the sign-up page at peterbcollins.com. A couple of new names to join the Trump cabinet. And this one comes as a bit of a relief to me because the Department of Homeland Security, at least the nominee here, is General John F. Kelly, the retired four-star Marine general who ran the Southern Command. He was one of the first commandants, at least top brass, in charge of Guantanamo. And I'm not too excited about General Kelly. And I still say we need to change the name of Homeland Security. It just has such a Germanic ring to it. But the silver lining here is that the nominee is not Kris Kobach, who is the Secretary of State of Kansas, the architect of some draconian immigration legal actions, and also the architect of the interstate cross-check list that Greg Palast exposed, one of the array of voter suppression tools used by Republicans in this year's election cycle. So we'll be hearing more about General Kelly and his adventures in the war in Iraq. And he is a bit of a hardliner, particularly about Guantanamo. He has rejected criticism from human rights activists about the treatment of prisoners there and said the program to force-feed prisoners who were hunger-striking was reasonable and humane. So I'm sure that makes him dear to the Trump team. Now, here is another stinky nomination qualifying for the Trump wrecking crew. That's the term I've been using for the people that he has recruited to run cabinet departments, people who are virulently opposed to the mission of those agencies. And he has selected Scott Pruitt, who is an ally of the Koch brothers, as we're going to detail for you in a moment. He's the Attorney General of Oklahoma, where they have fracking-related earthquakes there on a frequent basis. And he is a long opponent of the coal regulations of the EPA that were put out under Obama. He is pro-fracking and just about pro-everything else when it comes to extracting carbon from the earth. And he is one of the people who is in league with the network of the Koch brothers. And so this is extremely problematic. And we're going to have an ally of the energy industries in charge of the agency that attempts to regulate them. And what's interesting is Scott Pruitt, back in 2014, was exposed because he sent form letters that had been drafted by energy industry lobbyists to the EPA, where he hopes to work soon, the Interior Department, Office of Management and Budget, and President Obama, outlining the economic hardship of environmental rules aimed at reducing carbon emissions. And as the New York Times politely reports, he is close to Harold G. Hamm, Hamm spelled with two M's, and Hamm is the chief executive of Continental Energy. He was co-chairman of Pruitt's reelection campaign in 2013. Ah, but there's more about the Koch brothers and Scott Pruitt, the Guardian newspaper in London, publishing a piece, Dateline Washington, about how the Koch brothers network, which didn't invest in the election of Donald Trump to any significant degree, if you remember, they had threatened to spend $900 million during the 2016 election cycle, and they only spent about $250 million. It was mostly on Senate and House races, and they did not step in to support Trump. All's forgiven, though, among the billionaires, because the Koch network is benefiting greatly. You've got, what's her name, DeVos? I'm sorry. she is the daughter of the Betsy DeVos. There she is. She's nominated for education secretary, and she, of course, comes out of the Amway fortune of Michigan. And in addition to being pro-energy, the Koch brothers network is also trying to dismantle the public public school system by promoting charter schools and vouchers as a way to allow people to escape public schools and allow them to collapse. So it's also reported here that our good pal Hamm here is going to keep running Continental Resources, but he has pushed for nomination of Oklahoma's Governor Mary Fallon to be named Interior Secretary, and the nomination of Scott Pruitt, which now has been achieved, to run the EPA. And we give it even more on the Koch brothers network and energy cabal from today's great article by Steve Horn, our friend who publishes at DSmog Blog. And what he tells us is that Jeff Sessions, nominated for Attorney General, was the guy who wrote what became called the Halliburton loophole. And it's interesting because the energy industry has been combating issues related to water contamination from fracking and other forms of underground injection going back to the 1980s. And some of the first complaints about contaminated water surfaced in Alabama, which led Jeff Sessions to write a law to protect the industry that contaminates the water, not to protect the water for the citizens of Alabama. So this all occurred before Gasland. Here is an account from 1999. A woman says, I turned my dishwasher and faucets on, got huge globs of black jellied grease bearing the strong odor of petroleum. I no longer wondered, but knew at once that my suspicions were correct, that the underground aquifer, which supplied our drinking water well, was affected by the fracture of the gas well, and that I and my family were the innocent victims of drinking and bathing in water contaminated with toxic chemicals and radioactive materials. So, you represent people, you hear a complaint by that? First thing you do is insulate the industry that's causing the problem, and then you go on the Senate floor and lie about it. Jeff Sessions said in 1999 that fracking has never been attributed to causing even a single case of contamination to an underground drinking water source. Then Steve Horn makes the connection between Jeff Sessions' legislation, which was attached to a bill in 2005 and became law, and the obscure Interstate Compact. It's called the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission, and it's based right around the corner from the state capitol in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I recall Steve Horn went there a couple of years ago and almost got arrested by the local cops because he tried to present himself to interview some of the people at the compact. So that compact is run by, you guessed it, Harry Hamm. And he was part of the effort to pass what became the Halliburton loophole. It was an amendment to the Safe Drinking Water Act that basically said, ignore fracking. It's okay. Vice News today is reporting commentary from attorneys familiar with the litigation and the situation at Standing Rock, North Dakota. And they argue that if President Trump tries to reverse the denial by the Corps of Engineers of the easement for the pipeline company to complete the pass under Lake Oahe, that it's going to take time. Trump, an attorney from Earth Justice, Phil Ellis, says Trump can't just snap his fingers. We're talking a year or years as opposed to months or weeks. Now, this is encouraging, but what if the pipeline company decides that they're going to just thumb their noses? They're under a lot of financial pressure to complete this by January 1st in order to avoid the risk of losing out on contracts. In court filings, they've reported losing more than $450 million due to the delays so far and say that it would cost them tens of millions of dollars each month. But the Corps of Engineers says that if they are defied and that if the energy pipeline company advances the pipeline more than 200 feet toward the lake, that the Corps of Engineers will take enforcement action. That's somewhat encouraging, but I think it's wise of the water protectors to maintain their camp at Standing Rock. And this is shocking, but in Paris, the smog, the pollution is so bad that for the last 2 days, they have limited the use of automobiles. On Tuesday, vehicles with odd number plates were banned from driving, and on Wednesday, the even number vehicles had to stay off the road. The conditions are described here as very serious. High levels of nitrogen in the atmosphere there. And let's see, the situation is described here as that high levels of pollutant gases and fine lead particles are in the air, and that this is the result of anticyclonic weather conditions with light winds and a cold snap that basically creates an inversion and keeps the pollution from escaping. Now, this is not a surprise, but keep in mind that Donald Trump said he was going to drain the swamp and that lobbyists would, you know, have no place in his administration. Now consider that last week he accepted a phone call from the leader of Taiwan, which has created a diplomatic crisis with China because it violates the nominal One China rule that was put in place by Ronald Reagan back around 1982. Now, this was not an accident. Trump initially tried to play it off as, oh, yeah, she just called to congratulate me. Wouldn't you take the call? But this appears to be an intentional effort by the Trump administration to redefine the One China rule. And as I said the other day, I'm not unalterably opposed to modifications in this. It actually seems silly that we have this agreement where we can supply unlimited arms and munitions to Taiwan, but we don't offer recognition of Taiwan. And I understand the complications of it. My biggest point is that this should not be occurring during the transition. Trump is not president yet, and he has no basis to interfere in the diplomacy of the Obama administration until Obama leaves office. So now we learn that a paid lobbyist named Bob Dole, a paid foreign agent for the government of Taiwan, Bob Dole, the former Kansas senator, the presidential candidate of the Republicans in 1996, the Viagra pitchman, Bob Dole received, his firm got $140,000 over the last 6 months to cozy up to the Trump team, and they got their way. Trump went along with not only accepting the phone call, but appears to be ready to reset these relationships. And as I say, that may be appropriate after January 20th. Bob Dole has been sympathetic to Taiwan since the opening of China under the Nixon administration. And he's been a paid lobbyist for them, a foreign agent, for some time. Now, to be fair to Bob Dole, he's not the only former official who has cashed in and become a foreign agent for the nation of Taiwan. Former Democratic House Leader Richard Gephardt and the former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle are both reportedly getting $25,000 a month to flack for Taiwan. Isn't Washington beautiful? Why drain the swamp when your friends are making money? A couple of quickies here. The Republicans on Capitol Hill are very active in the lame duck session. They're jamming all kinds of elements into bills that must pass to avoid a government shutdown this weekend. They threw another $10 billion that the Pentagon didn't ask for into a supplemental war funding package. $4 billion more for disaster relief for Louisiana and some other states. They finally coughed up $170 million for the water system, the lead-tainted water system in Flint, Michigan. And the AP describes this appropriately. The bill that is being passed is an omnibus budget package that is described as the final legislative locomotive to leave the station before Congress closes up shop at the end of the year. Now, one other odious element that was jammed in there is a waiver that would allow General James Mattis to serve as Secretary of Defense. Currently, he is ineligible because of a law that requires a 7-year wait for former members of the military to serve as Secretary of Defense. And so they pushed that into the bill. Democrats insisted that it take 60 votes in the Senate to deliver that waiver. So we'll see how that plays out. Meanwhile, headlines report that the Islamic State is losing ground both in Mosul, Iraq, and in Aleppo, Syria. It remains to be seen if they will be routed from those positions as the U.S. and its murky team of allies hope. And finally today, some justice for Rasmea O'Day. You may never have heard of her. She's a Palestinian-American activist. And she came to the United States back in the 1990s, filled out her immigration papers, and later was convicted of immigration fraud in 2014. And a federal appeals court ordered the trial judge to give her a new trial. And he has. It's based on the exclusion of professional witnesses who would address her state of mind when she filled out her immigration forms. She was accused of omitting the fact that she was convicted by Israel and sent to prison. And she was tortured while she was in prison. And her legal team argues that it was PTSD that caused her to forget to include that. There's also a simple explanation that she may have felt when she was filling out the forms that it only had to do with what had happened since she came to the United States, where she was never arrested or convicted. So this is a real injustice that had been committed, and I am pleased to see that at least the courts will grant her a new trial. We'll be watching it, and I thank you for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You can find it every day free on YouTube. Be sure to share that with your friends. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.